If you have your Bibles, phones, tablets, Gospel of Mark, we're going to go to chapter 14. Let me catch you up a little bit. We've been in Mark for 5 months now, I think. Just grinding through. We're getting to the very end. There's two chapters left after this morning. And if you remember, I actually spoke 2 weeks ago, and I spoke on the first half of Mark chapter 14. And that was the introduction of communion. They were actually celebrating the Passover, which was a festival from the Old Testament where God brought them out of Egypt. There's a lot there that I'm not going to be able to get into. You can go back and listen to that. So Jesus is with his disciples. They're in a room, and they're celebrating this meal. And Jesus is like, hey, for this meal, you normally break bread. Well, now that's my body. You also normally drink multiple cups of wine that represent different things. Those now represent my blood. So he's foreshadowing. He's looking forward to the cross. So that was 2 weeks ago. Then last Sunday, Kevin said, hold on, we're going to put it in reverse. He wanted to go back to chapter 13 and cover a few things there. So that's what happened last Sunday. And now today we're going to pick up in verse 32, and we're going to go to verse 42 of chapter 14. I did make a slide that shows the parallel passages. So if you're someone that wonders, hey, where's it at in Matthew? Where's it at in Luke? The story that we're going to get to today, the Garden of Gethsemane, is in all three of these Gospels, and those are the three spots. So if you're someone that likes to take notes and have those, you have that there. Before we dive in, I have a question, and I obviously felt this last night with our loss. Have you ever felt distressed? Have you ever felt troubled? Next one, teenagers are gonna, yes, yes, yes. Have you ever felt anxious? Yeah, there, like the whole group is like, yeah. Have you ever just that? You ever had that knot in your stomach? Like something's happened or just something and you're just like, ah, this is terrible. On Monday, I took both of our kids, Piper and Oliver, went to Mount Hebron. And we go to the playground. I usually plan for this. I bring snacks, we bring water bottles, and we normally take things with us. Piper brought three stuffed animals. Rudolph got to go around the merry-go-round a bunch. Like, Rudolph was tired after. Oliver brought remote control cars. He got two for Christmas. He and I got to drive some. Then he started playing with some other kids, and they were driving them. We were there for like 2.5 hours. It was wonderful, 60 degrees that day. If you've ever been to the Mount Hebron Park, it's awesome. It's really awesome. So we go to leave, and he's playing hide-and-seek. I say, hey, I got everything except your water bottle and your blue remote control car. They're sitting on the bench where all of our stuff was. I'm going to take Piper, get the van, pull back up, and I'll holler at you to come out. Yes, I could see my kids the whole time. By the way, it was right there. I didn't leave my kid alone at the playground. So I went, got the van. Again, it's 100 steps away from the playground. I could see him. We pulled back up. He hopped in the car. We left. 30 seconds later, I said, hey, where's your water bottle? Where's your car at? He said, what are you talking about? I said, did you grab the stuff I told you to grab? He said, I didn't even hear you. I was playing hide and seek. I have no idea what you're talking about. So we turn around, because we were right down the street. We turn around, go back. He jumps out of the car, walks over to the bench, and comes back with his water bottle only. And I said, where's your car at? He said, it wasn't there anymore. So what do you mean it's not there? So I said, get in the car. I park the van right there, and right next to it, in the fire lane where you're not supposed to park. Sorry. And I run over, and I check. It's not on the bench. I said, well, maybe the kid he was playing with saw that we had left, so he grabbed it, and he was looking for us. So now I'm looking for this kid, not knowing. Didn't see the kid. I'm looking around the playground. I don't see it anymore. So I come back to the car, and I said, hey, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. My guess is someone was trying to help, and they couldn't find us. So maybe they took it with them, because why leave it at the playground? It's going to rain. It's going to ruin it. So maybe they took it with them. He said, no, I need to look again. I'm going to go check some bags. I mean, he was ready. He's ready to go. He put the gloves on. He got in the ring. So he gets back out of the car, and he's zooming around this playground for like 5 minutes looking for his RC car. And here's what happens. And if you're a parent, and I really don't know what happened to the car. But if you've ever had something stolen from you or something stolen from your child or lost something in a moment, and that look that you see on them, as he walked towards the car, I've never seen him just so down. He was just troubled, like in his heart, like, why would someone do this to me? And to kind of add to this, not only was it a Christmas present, he got it 2 days ago because my in-laws brought it back from Texas. It's like he played with it once before that day, and he was just like broken. Now, as the dad I am, when he got in the car, I had Amazon pulled up. I said, which one do you want? And I ordered him another one. Okay, right away, I came in and fixed that. We've already been back to the playground with the new car and played. And so just so you know, he's okay. But I ask you that question. Have you ever felt distressed? Have you ever felt troubled? And I got to see it that day. And maybe for you, maybe it's a job. Maybe it's the holidays are really stressful. Maybe there's family members that you have to see or even deal with, and you're like, man, this is a tough time. Maybe it's a loss of a job. Maybe it's like where Kevin is right now. He's been literally in a hospital room for 3 days holding his best friend's hand who is passing. And maybe that's the distress that you've witnessed or been a part of. Maybe, you know, for you guys and college students, maybe it's a project. Maybe it's a teacher that they rub you wrong, you rub them wrong, whatever it is, and there's just this knot in your stomach when you know you gotta go to that class, you know you gotta turn that paper in, whatever it may be. And when we step into our text this morning, Jesus is distressed. Jesus is troubled. Jesus is anxious. His stomach is in a knot. Let's pick up in verse 32, and we're gonna read the whole thing, and then we'll come back to the beginning. Verse 32, here's what it says. Then they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus says to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply, here it is, distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." And going a little further, he fell to the ground. He prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and he found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for an hour? Watch and pray so that you may not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Verse 39, once more he went away and he prayed the same thing. And when he came back, he found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning a third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." So that's kind of the whole text. That's going to end chapter 14, and Pastor Kevin's going to be able to knock out 15 and 16 in the next 2 weeks. And what we're going to do, we're going to pause in those first six verses, 32 through 36. We're going to spend time not with the disciples and what was happening with them, but with Jesus. So let me read verse 32 again, back at the beginning. "Then they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I pray.'" And what I did, just researching this and trying to figure this out, because I wanted to help you kind of see, hey, what is, when he goes here, what imagery do we get? Maybe some of you have seen the kind of the original Passion of Christ by Mel Gibson, and you get to see that scene. Some of you have watched The Chosen, and you've got to see the scene there. Just through the research, I found a guy who's been there like in modern day times, where he can look and show everything. So here's about a 2-minute video of what Gethsemane looks like today.
Maybe. "After the Passover meal was complete, Jesus and his disciples left the borrowed room and went to Gethsemane. Now, Gethsemane is an olive grove. You can see it right down here. It's by the Kidron Valley on the lower slopes of the Mount of Olives. It's across the Kidron Valley from the Temple Mount, which you can see up there. Gethsemane means olive press in Hebrew, and it indicates that this was a commercial oil operation. Olive oil in the ancient world was a precious commodity, being used for everything from cooking to cleaning to skincare to lamp fuel. In addition to olive presses, Gethsemane was full of olive trees. In fact, there's still an olive grove preserved here today. The shelter of these trees made it a great place to seek solitude. It appears that Jesus and his disciples would come to a particular spot, a garden area buried within the olive groves. Jesus would take his closest friends here to rest and pray after long days in the temple complex. But this time it was different. Jesus was overwhelmed with anxiety. The Gospel of Matthew says that he told Peter, James, and John, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me.'" Matthew 26, 38. The Garden of Gethsemane, here at the foot of the Mount of Olives, is now protected by the walled grounds of the Church of All Nations, also known as the Church of the Agony. It's a peaceful garden among a grove of ancient olive trees, looking back at the eastern wall of the city of Jerusalem. It's here that the Gospel of Luke says Jesus knelt down and prayed.
And so that's, oh, the lights might come back on. There we go. That is the what it looks like today. So if you got to go over there and visit and see that, that's what it looks like today. And he mentioned this. Gethsemane literally means pressing of oils or olive press. And there's two pictures. We show that first picture. And so this is actually an olive press. They had this big basin, and they would dump all the olives in, and then there's big stones that would sit on that, and they would turn and kind of churn it, and they would break them up. Most of the time, they would use animals. Donkeys would be used, but you could also use people. You can also look up, there's a YouTube video of Gordon Ramsay going over there and wanting oil, so he does it himself. So that's kind of fun to watch if you want to see that. So this is the crushing side, okay? And I'm going to get to the point. This will make sense here in a second. And then there's the pressing side. So once it's all crushed, it turns into like a mush. And then they take that and they put it in wicker baskets. Show that second photo. So that's the basket. It's already crushed. So they fill that and then they set blocks on it and stones and wooden beams up to 1,000 pounds. And then the oil starts to come out of the wicker basket. Okay? And here's why this matters. And he kind of mentioned it there. Oil was very precious. It was used for lots of things. On the religious side of things, though, for the Jews, it was used in the temple for the lamps. It was used for anointing of priests, and it was used in certain offerings. And what it is, Jesus taking them here specifically on this day at this time, he is foreshadowing what is going to happen. Here's what Isaiah 53 verse 5 says. He was pierced for our transgressions. And here it is. He was crushed for our iniquities. This is another word for sin. The punishment that brought us peace with God was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. There is a crushing that has to happen on the cross. And being at Gethsemane is literally the press, the crushing of olive oil, the crushing of olives. And so Jesus is looking towards the cross because the cross is soon. Let's go to verse 33 and 34. He took Peter and James and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed. That's what we started talking about earlier, and troubled. And my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. One commentator said this: this describes an extremely acute emotion, a compound of bewilderment, fear, anxiety, uncertainty. Nowhere else portrayed in such vivid terms as here. Charles Spurgeon, a preacher from the 1800s, he says this of his sorrow: the agony of Gethsemane is a prelude to the agony of Calvary. And Calvary would be where Jesus is crucified. That the agony of Gethsemane in the garden, it's a prelude. It's a preparation. The pain begins here. What's going to happen on Calvary, it's a prelude to that. Isaiah chapter 53, in the first half of it, in the New Living Translation, says this: he was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with the deepest grief. In this moment in the garden, again, he's not on the cross yet, but it's a preparation. It's pointing towards, he right after this, he gets arrested. He goes on trial. He's beaten, he's put on a cross. I mean, it's all happening right here, and it's beginning in the garden. In this moment, there's two things he experiences: the wrath of God and the weight of sin. So he's beginning to feel the weight. He knows what's coming. He knows that the wrath of God is coming on him, and he knows the weight of sin, trillions of sin across time and centuries, will now be applied to him in the next couple of days. That weight will be applied to him, and he begins to feel this man of sorrows, this grief. He feels that weight. Let's continue in verse 35. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Jesus, in this moment, I want you to imagine that Jesus came into the world to die on the cross. Yet now he's very close to the cross and he's asking God, is there someone else? Could we not do it this way? Can someone else drink the cup? Can someone else, is there another way? God, you can do it. Everything is possible. Is there another way than what's about to happen to me? His humanity, Son of Man, his humanity is coming through here, and you see the pain. And there's an odd word here we're going to pause on. There's a word cup. For me, I think of drinking a cup of water at home. It's very simple. Some of you have cups and bottles, coffee with you, a cup of coffee from the lobby. But what does it mean? Let me give you two Old Testament references. Isaiah 51:17. Wake up. Wake up, O Jerusalem. You have drunk the cup of the Lord's fury. That also means wrath. You have drunk the cup of terror, tipping out its last drops. And that's a prophecy for the people when they haven't followed God. Here's another one from Jeremiah. Same thing. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me. Take from my hand this cup filled to the brim with my anger, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink from it. And so I know for some of you hearing this, and same as me, I don't like an angry God, really. Like, I'm not a fan of wrath. I'm not a fan of a God that's maybe judgmental or furious with us and wrathful with us. So I want to take a moment, because some people are like, I don't really like the Old Testament God, but I really like the New Testament God. I've had people tell me, hey, I just don't really read the Old Testament a lot. I like to hang out in the New Testament, which if you had to choose one, I think the Gospels are probably the best place to hang, but the whole story is for us, right? The whole story is for us to learn from. We're going to do a quick exercise together. When I get to things like this, and we've dealt with this in our youth group before, I ask the students to do something. I said, if you had the opportunity and you had to choose and you got to create God, what attributes, what characteristics would you give God? How would you want God to be towards you? Like, what things would you want him to have? And I asked them to do that. And then I said, well, here's a couple things to think on. So we're going to kind of do this. I want you to just think for 10 seconds in your head. I'm going to get a drink. You think for 10 seconds. If there were a couple characteristics you would want God to be, you get to choose. What would they be? How would you make God? Here's three things I think most of us would put, if not all of us. Number one, we would want a just God. What do I mean by that? Just means based on or behaving according to what is morally right or fair. So if you got to create God somehow in some world that could happen, it couldn't, but you know what I mean for this exercise. I think all of us would want God to be fair. For God to have morals, a right and a wrong, right? So some boundaries, some guidelines. It's not all over the place, but there's fairness, there's rightness. I think we would all agree we would want a just God. Number two, we would want a holy God. What do I mean by that word? So really, in the best terms, it's not just separated from sin, but it's like opposite of sin. So sin's over there and God is over here because of who he is. I mean, look around you, look at the news, look at our world. Would you want God to be a part of any of that? Any of this? The sin in our world, the stain of sin? To me, I wouldn't. I would not want God to be anywhere near sin. So you have a holy God. So not only do you have a God that's fair, but you have a God that does not associate in any capacity with sin. That makes him holy, set apart, separate, opposite. Here's the third one. I think we would want God to love us. Pretty simple. So we want a God that's fair. We want a God that does nothing to do with sin, because we wouldn't want wrongdoing in him, right? And we want a God that loves us. So here's a question. Let's say you have a family member, a child, a spouse, a friend, a really good friend, and someone hurts them intentionally. They break into your home, destroy stuff, they hurt your children, whatever it may be. You can imagine, not too far, don't spiral, okay? Don't spiral. But something bad happens to someone you love. You get to go sit in the court, right? You get to go listen in the courthouse and the judge. And the judge simply says, not guilty, you're free to go. How would you feel in that moment as someone whose family or friend was wronged? Would that judge be a just judge, a loving judge, or a holy, in some capacity, judge? Here's what Tim Keller says. It's a great line. If God does not judge evil, then he does not love the world. If God does not judge evil, then he does not love the world. So when we get to this point, bringing it back to the cup of wrath, God's fury and wrath and judgment are byproducts of his love for us. That's what sin has caused, such pain and separation that God is literally required, because of his love, to have really wrath and anger towards that thing. that sin that separates us from him. So when we see this Old Testament, New Testament, it's not what we're looking at. That this cup of wrath is really God's love for us, just seen through that lens. Let's finish verse 36. We only read the first half of it. Mark 14, 36, New International Version says this. Yet, let me actually read back the whole verse. Verse 36, Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Again, the weight of sin and God's wrath is bearing down on Jesus. Take this cup from me, please. Yet, not what I will, but what you will. The NLT says it this way, yet I want your will to be done, not mine. The Message, which is a pure paraphrase, but please, not what I want, but what do you want? In this moment, Jesus' humanity is fully submitting to God's sovereign will in spite of his pain, in spite of the wrath, in spite of the weight of sin, the cup, the hour, this moment that he knows is coming. It's right after this. He submits to God's will and says, not my will, but your will. So here's what I want to do. I want to give you a couple application questions. A couple things to wrestle with. If you got notes, your phone, whatever, you want to write these down. This is what I want you to wrestle with a little bit. Number one, are you trying to drink a cup never meant for you to drink? Are you trying to drink a cup never meant for you to drink? So what do I mean by that? Are you trying to achieve God's favor in some capacity? Do you feel like if you prayed instead of 6 times a day, maybe 7 times? If you read just one more chapter in a week, maybe God would love you more. Maybe God would bless you just a little bit more. Maybe you're someone when you sin, like you are just so down on yourself that you messed up. You're like, man, I did it again. Maybe you assume, we've been talking about God's anger, right? That God is angry with you. Or he wants to punish you. I would say God is angry for you, okay, because of sin. And the separation it causes and the relationship he wants with you. Here's the truth with this question. Are you trying to drink a cup never meant for you to drink? Jesus drank the cup of wrath so you could be right with God. What I want you to know that is that Jesus drank the cup of wrath so that you could be right with God. Yet, some of us in this room, and I have been there at times, still try to drink that cup. Still try to make it right by what we do, the things that we accomplish. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says this, for God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin so that we could be made right with God through Christ. We might be made right. Second question for you to think on. Are you looking for God's blessings but living by your will? Are you looking for God's blessings, but living by your will? Maybe it's this hope, God, you'll bless my family, but it's my will be done. God, you'll bless my career and you'll help me move up and then I can provide for my family and I can get that job, I can get that corner window, whatever it is, the sunshine, all of that, but it's my will be done. Well, what about school? God, I want to do great in high school. I want to do great in junior high. I want to do great going into college. I want to get the best ACT score. I want to get all these scholarships and get college paid for. Maybe the first person in my family to graduate. But I really want to be the one in control of what happens. God, what about my finances? I want to make more money. I want to make a lot of money. Maybe we already do, but God, I want to make more and more and more. But I want to be in control of that. I want to be in control of where that money goes. What about my life? I just want the Lord to bless my life, yet I'm the one in charge of it. We want God's blessings, yet we seek our own will. We sang this song earlier. It's literally this. Seek first his will and his blessings will follow. Seek first his will and his blessings will follow. Matthew 6, 33, the Lord will provide it. This is what that song is written from. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. And I would encourage you to go read Matthew 6 and get the context to all of that. But seek first his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Here's how I begin to wrap up our morning. If you have Bibles, you can turn to Genesis. I'm not going to read from it, but what happens in Genesis is God creates everything. We see that in the first couple chapters. He creates birds, sky, animals, and then he creates Adam and Eve, the first two people. And in the garden, God walks with them. Sin had yet to stain the world, and God is walking with them. And there's a word that's used, and I remember I spoke on this about a year and a half ago. There's a word used called shalom. Today we translate that to peace. That's a very vague translation of that. What it means is absolute wholeness. It's harmonious, joyful, flourishing life with God, in God, through God. Harmonious, joyful, flourishing life. In the Garden of Eden, we lost that peace. We lost that flourishing life. We lost shalom in that garden. Here's what Romans 5 says, verse 18 and 19. Yes, Adam's one sin brings condemnation for everyone. He introduced sin to humanity. But Christ's one act of righteousness brings a right relationship with God and new life for everyone. And he says it again. Because one person disobeyed God, many become sinners. But because one other person obeyed God, many will be made righteous. And if you're in the book of Romans, you go forward three more chapters, you hit verse 1, it says, therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Here's my question as we close this out. Which garden are you living in? Are you in Eden and you're saying my will? Because that's what Adam and Eve said. They're right here in this Garden of Eden. They say, Lord, it is not your will, it is my will. Or are you in the Garden of Gethsemane saying, Lord, it's not my will, but it's your will. Which garden are you living in? The term that Kelsey and I have used, which come from her friend Leslie that happens to be here. Which garden are you watering? Which garden are you investing in? Your will, your kingdom, God's will, and God's kingdom. I want to invite our band up. We're actually going to sing a song called Who Else? And one of the things is Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. He literally asked, could this hour pass? And he asked God to take the cup. The reason the hour could not pass, the reason the cup could not pass to someone else is because no one else is worthy. Jesus is the only one worthy to make us right before God. And this song literally says, who else is worthy? That's what we're going to sing. If y'all stand, I'm going to pray over you. And then we'll sing a final song. Jesus, we thank you for the second garden. God, we thank you for, I hate to say it this way, but the sorrow, the pain, the troubling that Jesus had to experience. But he did that for us. He did that for all of us so that we could have a right relationship with you, that we could be restored to Eden. We could be restored to shalom, into a life walking with you, Lord. That was the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus took that cup for us. And Lord, we are so thankful for that. We are so thankful for your blessing, God, your love, your holiness, your justness in our lives. And Lord, right now, help us to focus not on our will, but on your will. Help us not to focus on creating our own righteousness and drinking our own cup to get to you, but to look to Jesus and his righteousness, to look to him and his will. God, help us to say, not I, but you. Lord, I pray for everyone in this room as they go back to school tomorrow, they go back to work tomorrow, back on the grind. And Lord, that they can focus in on you. God, that they can water the right garden and they can choose to follow your will and not theirs. Lord, we lift all this to you and trust this to you. And everyone said,